confusion, you cannot help glancing off toward the far end of the infirmary where Alabaster still sits, unnoticed by the infirmary's new guests. His stone eater stands where you last saw her, though her gaze is also fixed on the tableau. You can see Alabaster's face over the beds. His eyes slide over to meet yours, but then they shift away. Your attention is recaptured by the man on the bed, as some of the people around him step back. At first, you can't tell what the problem is, other than that his pants seem oddly wet in patches, caked with muddy ash. The wetness isn't red, it's not blood. But there's a smell that you're not sure how to describe. Meat in brine. Hot fat. His boots are off, bearing feet which still spasmodically twitch a little, the splayed toes relaxing only reluctantly, even in unconsciousness. Lerna is cutting open one pant's leg with a pair of scissors. What you notice first as he peels away the damp cloth are the small round blue hemispheres that dot the man's skin here and there, each perhaps 2 inches in diameter and 1 inch in rounded height, shiny and foreign to his flesh. There are 10 or 15 of them. Each sits at the center of a patch of bloated pink-brown flesh covering perhaps a hand span of the man's legs. You think the lumps are jewels at first. That's kind of what they look like. Metallic over the blue. And beautiful. "Fuck," says someone, voice soft with shock. And someone else says, "What the rust?" Someone else pushes into the infirmary behind you after a moment's argument with the people who've blocked off the door. She comes to stand beside you, and you look over at Yika, whose eyes widen in confusion and revulsion for an instant before she schools her expression to blankness. Then she says, sharply enough to jerk people out of staring, "What happened?" You notice, belatedly or perhaps right in time, that another stone eater is in the room, not far beyond the tableau. She's familiar, the red-haired one who greeted you along with Yika when you first came to Kastrima. She's watching Yika now, avidly, but her stone gaze occasionally drifts toward you, too. You suddenly become hyper-aware that Hoa did not follow you from the apartment.
"Outer, perimeter, patrol,"
says another ash-covered mid-ladder man to Yika. He doesn't look like a strongback, too small. Maybe he's one of the new hunters. He comes around the bedside group and fixes his gaze on Yika as if she is all that prevents him from staring at the injured man until his mind breaks.
"We were out by the salt quarry, thinking it might be a good place for hunting. There was some kind of sinkhole near a stream runnel. Beled, I don't know, he's gone. I heard them both scream at first, but I didn't know why. I was upstream looking at some animal tracks. By the time I got there, it was just Tertius there, looking like he was trying to climb out of the ash. I helped him out, but they were on him already, and more were crawling up his shoes, so I had to cut them off."
A hiss jerks your eyes away from the speaking man. Lerna is shaking his hand, holding out the fingers stiffly as if they hurt.
"Get me the rusting forceps," he says to another man,
who twitches and turns to do so. You've never heard Lerna curse before.
"Some kind of boil,"
says the sunset woman who injected the man. She sounds disbelieving. She's speaking to Lerna as if trying to convince him rather than herself. Lerna just keeps grimly probing the edges of the burns with his uninjured hand, ignoring her.
"Has to be. He fell into a stream vent, a geyser, an old rusted-out geopipe."
Which would make the bugs just a coincidence.
"Or they would have gotten on me, too."
The other hunter is still talking in his hollow voice.
"I thought the sinkhole was just loose ash, but it was really, I don't know, like an anthill."
The hunter swallows, sets his jaw.
"I couldn't get the rest off, so I brought him here."
Yika's lips press together, but she rolls up her sleeves and goes over, pushing through the other shocked people nearby. She yells,
"Back up! If you don't need to help with this, get out of the rusting way!"
Some of the milling people start pulling others away, Someone else grabs for one of the jewel objects and tries to pull it off, then jerks her hand away, yelping, as Lerna did. The object changes, two pieces of the shiny blue surface flaking away and lifting before clapping back into place. And suddenly it shifts in your head. It's not a jewel, it's a bug, some kind of beetle, and the iridescent shell is its carapace. In the moment that it lifted its wing covers, you saw that its round body was translucent, with something jumping and bubbling inside. You can sense the heat of it even from where you are, hot as a boil. The man's flesh steams around it. Someone gives Lerna the forceps and he tries to pull one of the beetles off. Its wing covers lift again, and a thin jet of something skeets across Lerna's fingers. He yelps and drops the forceps, jerking back. Acid, someone says. Someone else grabs his hand and tries to quickly wipe off the stuff, but you know what it is even before Lerna gasps, "No! Just water. Scalding water." "Careful," says the other hunter, belatedly. One of his hands bears a line of blisters, you notice. You also notice that he doesn't look back at the infirmary table or any of the people there. This is too horrible to watch. The rusting bugs are boiling the man to death. But when you look away, you see that Alabaster is watching you again. Alabaster, who himself is covered in burns, but who should be dead. No one stands near the epicenter of a continent-spanning fissure vent and gets only patchy third-degree burns. He should have been ashes scattered over Eumenes's melted streets. You realize this as he gazes at you, though his expression is indifferent to another man's trial by fire. It is a familiar sort of indifference, fulcrum familiar. It is the indifference that comes of too many betrayals, too many friends lost for no good reason, too many, too horrible to watch, atrocities seen. And yet, the reverberation of Alabaster's orogeny is carelessly powerful, diamond precise, and so achingly familiar that you have to close your eyes and fight off memories of a heaving ship deck, a lonely high road, a windy rock island. The torus that he spins is devastatingly small, barely an inch wide, so attenuated that you cannot find its hairpin fulcrum. He's still better than you. Then you hear a gasp. You open your eyes to see one of the bugs shiver, hiss like a living tea kettle, and then freeze over. Its legs, which had been hooked into the boiled flesh around it, pop loose. It's dead. But then you hear a soft groan, and the orogeny dissipates. You look over to see that Alabaster has bowed his head and hunched over. His stone-eater's slow grind crouches beside him, something in her posture indicating concern, even if her face is as placid as ever. The red-haired stone-eater, in internal exasperation you decide to call her Ruby Hair for now, is gazing at him, too. That's it, then. You look back at the man, and your gaze catches on Lerna, who's looking at the frozen bug in fascination. His eyes lift, sweep the room, stutter across yours, stop. You see the question there, and start to shake your head. No, you did not freeze the bug. But that isn't the right question, and maybe it isn't even the answer he's asking. He doesn't need to know if you did. He needs to know if you can. Lerna, Hoa, Alabaster, today you are driven by silent, meaningful gazes, it seems. The hot points of the insects cess like geothermal vents as you step forward and focus your sesapine. Lots of controlled pressure in their tiny bodies. That's how they make the water boil. You lift a hand toward the man out of habit so everyone will know you're doing something, and you hear a curse. A hiss, a scramble of feet and jostling bodies as people move back from you, away from any torus you might manifest. Fools, don't they know you only need a torus when you have to pull from the ambient? The bugs have plenty of what you need. The difficulty will lie in confining your draw just to them, and not the man's overheated flesh underneath. Yika's stone eater takes a slow step closer. You assess her movement rather than seeing it. It's like a mountain shifting toward you. Then Ruby Hare stops, as suddenly there is another mountain in its way. Hoa, stock still, and quietly cold. Where did he come from? You cannot spare another thought for these creatures right now. You begin slowly, using your eyes as well as your sesapine to determine exactly where to stop. But Alabaster has shown you the way of it. You spin the Taurus from their hot little bodies as he did, one by one. As you do this, some of them crack open with a loud and violent hiss, and one of them even pops off, flying off toward the side of the room. People move out of its way even faster than they moved out of yours. Then it is done. Everyone stares at you. You look at Yika. You're breathing hard, because that degree of fine focus is much, much harder than shifting a hillside. Need anything shaken? She blinks, assessing instantly what you mean. Then she grabs your arm. There is, what? An inversion? Channeling away as you would do to an obelisk, except there is no obelisk, and you aren't doing the channeling even though it's your orogeny. All at once, you hear people exclaim outside, and you glance through the infirmary's door. The infirmary is a built building, not carved from one of the giant crystals of the geode. Inside, it's lit only by electric lamps. Outside, however, through the uncurtained doorway, you can see the geode crystals glowing noticeably brighter, all over the calm. You stare at Yika. She nods back at you in a matter-of-fact, collegial way, as if you should have a clue what she's just done, or as if you should be comfortable with a feral doing something that a ringed fulcrum or a gen can't. Then Yika steps over to grab another pair of forceps to help. Lerna's pulling on one of the beetles again, despite his scalded fingers, and this time the thing is coming off. A proboscis as long as its body slides out of the boiled flesh and, you can't look anymore. You glimpse Ruby Hare again, from the corner of your eye. She's ignoring Hoa, who stands still as a statue between you, and now she's smiling at Yika. Her lips are parted just a little. You glimpse a hint of shining teeth. You blot this from your awareness. So you retreat to the far end of the infirmary to sit down beside Alabaster's cushion pile. He's still bent over, breathing like a bellows, although the Stone Eater has taken hold of his shoulder with one vice-like hand to keep him mostly upright. Belatedly, you realize he's holding one of his stumpy wrists to his belly and... Oh, Earth. The gray-brown rock that once only capped his right wrist now sleeves up to his elbow. He lifts his head. Sweat sheens his face. He looks as weary as if he just shut down another supervolcano, although this time he's at least conscious and smiling.
"Ever the good pupil, Cyan," he murmurs. "But rusting Earth, it is costly to teach you."
The shock of understanding rings through you like silence. Alabaster can't do orogeny anymore. Not without consequences. Impulse makes you look at Antimony, and your gorge rises as you realize the Stone Eater's gaze is fixed on his newly stoned arm. She doesn't move, however. After a moment, Alabaster manages to straighten, throwing a grateful look at her for the supportive hand.
"Later,"
he says softly. You know this means... "Eat my arm later." She adjusts her hand to support him from behind instead. The urge to push her aside, put your hand in place to hold him up, is so powerful that you can't look at this either. You push yourself up, brush past everyone else to get outside the infirmary, and then you sit down on the low, flattened tip of a crystal that is only just beginning to glow out of the geode wall. No one bothers you, though you feel the pressure of gazes and hear the echo of whispers. You don't mean to stay long, but you do. You don't know why. Eventually, a shadow falls over your feet. You look up to see Lerna standing there. Beyond him, Yika is walking away with another man who is trying to talk to her. She seems to be angrily ignoring him. The rest of the crowd has dispersed at last, though you can see through the open doorway that there's still more people in the infirmary than usual, perhaps visiting the poor half-cooked hunter. Lerna isn't looking at you. You're staring at the far wall of the geode, which is lost in the hazy glow from dozens of crystals between here and there. He's also smoking a cigarette. The stench of it, and the yellowish color of the outer wrapping, tells you it's a mellow. Derminthermilla leaves and flower buds, mildly narcotic when dried. The Somidlats are famous for them, to the degree that the Somidlats can be famous for anything. You're still surprised to see him smoking one, though. He's a doctor. Mellows are bad for you. You all right? You ask. He doesn't answer at first, taking a long drag on the cigarette. You're starting to think he won't speak when he says, I'm going to kill him when I go back in there. Then you understand. The bugs burned through skin, muscle, maybe even down to the bone. With a team of humanescent doctors and cutting-edge biomestric drugs, maybe the man could be kept alive long enough to heal. And even then, he might never walk again. With just whatever equipment and medicines Kastrima has to hand, the best Lerna can do is amputate. The man might survive it. But this is a season, and every calm dweller must earn their shelter from the ash and cold. Few comms have use for a legless hunter, and this comm is already supporting one burned invalid. Yika walking away, ignoring a man who sounds like he's arguing for a life. So Lerna is very much not all right. You decide to change the subject slightly. I've never seen anything like those bugs. The locals say they're called boil bugs, though no one knew why before now. They breed around streams, carry water inside themselves. Animals eat them during droughts. Usually they're carrion eaters. Harmless. Lerna flicks ash from his forearm. He's wearing only a loose, sleeveless shirt due to Kastrima's warmth. The skin of his forearms is flecked with something. You look away. Things change during a season, though. Yes. Cooked carrion probably lasts longer. You could have gotten those things off him the instant you walked in the door, Lerna adds. You blink. Then it registers in your mind that this statement was an attack. It's so mildly delivered from such an unexpected quarter that you're too surprised to be angry. I couldn't. You say. At least I didn't know I could. Alabaster, I don't expect anything from him. He came to die here, not live here. Lerna pivots to face you, and all of a sudden you realize that his placid manner has been concealing absolute rage. His gaze is cool, but it's visible in everything else. His white lips, the flecks of muscle in his jaw, his flaring nostrils. Why are you here, Essen? You flinch. You know why. I came to find Nossun. Nossun's out of your reach. Your goals have changed. Now you're here to survive, same as the rest of us. Now you're one of us. His lip curls in something that might be contempt. I'm saying this because if I don't make you understand, you might have a rusting fit and kill us all. You open your mouth to reply, He takes a step toward you, though, and it's so aggressive that you actually sit up.
Tell me you won't, Ersun. Tell me I won't have to leave this calm in the dead of the night, hoping nobody you've pissed off catches me and slits my throat. Tell me I'm not going to have to go back out there to fight for my life and watch people I try to help die again and again and again until I get eaten by rusting bugs.
He cuts himself off with a choked sound, turning away sharply. You stare at his tense back and say nothing, because there's nothing you can say. This is the second time he's mentioned your murder of Terimo. And is that surprising? He was born there, grew up there. Lerna's mother was still living there when you left, you think. Maybe you killed her too that last day. There's nothing you can say, not with guilt souring your mouth, but you try anyway. I'm sorry. He laughs. It doesn't even sound like him, it's so ugly and angry. Then he resumes his former posture, gazing at the far geode wall. He's more in control of himself now. The muscle in his jaw isn't jumping quite so much.
Prove you're sorry.
You shake your head, in confusion rather than refusal.
How?
Words spreading. A couple of the biggest gossips in the calm were with Yiko when she met you, and apparently you confirmed what a lot of the Ragas have been whispering among themselves. You almost flinch at his use of Raga. He was such a polite boy once.
Topside, you said this season won't end for thousands of years. Was that an exaggeration or the truth?
You sigh, rub a hand over your hair. It's a thick, curly mess at the roots. You need to retwist your locks, but you haven't because you haven't had time and because it feels like there's no point.
Seasons always end, you say.
Father Earth keeps his own equilibrium. It's just a question of how long it will take.
How long?
It's barely a question. His tone is flat, resigned. He suspects the answer already. And he deserves your honest, best guess.
10,000 years?
For the humanus rifting to stop venting and the skies to clear. Not long at all by the usual scale of tectonics. But the real danger lies in what the ash might set off. Enough ash covering the warm surface of the sea, and the ice might grow at the poles. That means saltier seas, drier climates, permafrost, glaciers marching, spreading, and the most habitable part of the world should that happen, the equatorials, will still be hot and toxic. It's the winter that really kills during seasons. Starvation, exposure. Even after the skies clear, though, the rift could cause an age of winter that lasts millions of years. None of which matters, because humanity will have gone extinct long before. It'll be just the obelisks floating over plains of endless white, with no one left to wonder at or ignore them. His eyelids flicker.
Huh.
To your surprise, he turns to face you. Even more surprising is that his anger seems to be gone, though it has been replaced by a kind of bleakness that feels familiar.
It's his question, though, that floors you.
So what are you planning to do about it?
Your mouth actually falls open.
After a moment, you manage to reply, I wasn't aware there was anything I could do about it. Just like you hadn't thought there was anything you could do about the boil bugs. Alabaster is the genius. You're the grunt.
What are you and Alabaster doing with the obelisks?
What is Alabaster doing? You correct. He just asked me to summon one. Probably because... it hurts to say. He can't do that kind of orogeny anymore.
Alabaster made the rift, didn't he?
You close your mouth fast enough that your teeth clack. You've just said Alabaster can't do orogeny anymore. Enough Kostremans hear that they're living in an underground rock garden because of him, and they'll find a way to kill him, stone eater or not. Lerna smiles lopsidedly.
It's not hard to put together, Aesun. His wounds are from steam, particulate abrasion, and corrosive gas, not fire. Characteristic of being in close proximity to an erupting burn. I don't know how he survived, but it's left its mark on him. He shrugged.
And I've seen you destroy a town in 5 minutes without breaking a sweat. So I've got an inkling of what a ten ringer might be capable of. What are the obelisks for?
You set your jaw.
You can ask me 6 different ways, Lerna, and I'll give you 6 different versions of I don't know, because I don't.
I think you at least have an idea.
But lie to me if you want. He shakes his head. This is your calm now.
He falls silent after that, as if expecting a response from you.
You're too busy vehemently rejecting the idea to respond.
But he knows you too well. He knows you don't want to hear it. That's why he says it again.
Aesun Raga Kastrima. That's who you are now.
No. Leave, then.
Everyone knows Yika can't really hold you if you put your mind to leaving. I know you'll kill us all if you feel the need. So go.
You sit there, looking at your hands, which dangle between your knees. Your thoughts are empty. Lerna inclines his head.
You aren't leaving because you aren't stupid. Maybe you can survive out there, but not as anything Nasun would ever want to see again. And if nothing else, you want to live so that you can eventually find her again. However unlikely that is.
Your hands twitch once, then they resume dangling limply.
When this season doesn't end, Lerna continues, and it is so much worse that he does it in the same weary monotone which asked how long the season would last, like he's speaking utter truth and knows it and hates it. We'll run out of food. Cannibalism will help, but it's not sustainable. At that point, the calm will either turn raider or simply dissolve into roving bands of calmless. But even that won't save us long term. Eventually, the remnants of Kastrima will just starve. Father Earth wins at last.
It's the truth, whether you want to face it or not. And it's further proof that whatever happened to Lerna during his brief calmless career changed him. Not really for the worse. It's just made him the kind of healer who knows that sometimes one must inflict terrible agony. Re-break a bone, carve off a limb, kill the weak, in order to make the whole stronger.
Nasun strong like you, he continues, softly and brutally.
Say she survives, Jija. Say you find her. Bring her here, or any other place that seems safe. She'll starve with the rest when the store cache is empty. But with her orogeny, she could probably force others to give her their food. Maybe even kill them and have the remaining stores for herself. Eventually, the stores will run out, though. She'll have to leave the calm, scrape by on whatever forage she can find under the ash, hopefully while not running afoul of the wildlife or other hazards. She'll be one of the last to die. Alone. Hungry. Cold. Hating herself. Hating you. Or maybe she'll have shut down by then. Maybe she'll just be an animal, driven only by the instinct to survive and failing even at that. Maybe she'll eat herself in the end. The way any beast might.
Stop, you say. It's a whisper. Mercifully, he does. Turns away again instead, taking another long drag of his half-forgotten mellow.
Have you talked to anyone since you got here? He asks, finally.
It's not really a change of subject. You don't relax. He nods toward the infirmary.
Anyone but Alabaster and that menagerie you've been traveling with? More than a meeting? Talked?
Not enough to count.
You shake your head.
The rumor's spreading, Aesun.
and now everyone's thinking about how slowly their children will die. He finally flicks away the mellow, still burning, thinking about how they can't do anything about it. But you can, he doesn't need to say. Can you? Lerna walks away so abruptly that you're surprised. You hadn't realized he was done. It's an ingrained flinch at the idea of waste that makes you go pick up his discarded cigarette. Takes you a moment to figure out how to inhale without choking. You've never tried before. Origins aren't supposed to ingest narcotics. But Origins aren't supposed to live, either, during a season. The Fulcrum had no store caches. No one ever mentioned it. But you're pretty sure that if a season ever hit Eumenes hard enough, the Guardians would have swept the place and slaughtered every one of you. Your kind is useful in preventing seasons, but if the Fulcrum ever so failed in its duty, if ever the worthies of the Black Star or the Emperor ever felt a whiff of a thought of a tremor, you and your fellow Imperial Origins would not have been rewarded with survival. And why should you have been? What survival skills does any Raga offer? You can keep people from dying in a shake. Yay. Fat lot of good that does when there's no food. Enough! You hear Yika's voice from a short distance away, though you can't see her around the ground-level crystals. She's shouting. It's done! You want to be there for it, or stay here wasting breath on me? You get up, your knees aching. Head in that direction. Along the way, you pass a young man whose face is streaked with tears of fury and incipient grief. He storms past you back to the infirmary. You keep going and eventually see Yika standing near the side of a high, narrow crystal. She's planted a hand against its wall and stands with her head bowed, her bush of hair falling around her face so you can't see it. You think she's shaking a little. Maybe that's your imagination. She seems so cold-hearted. But then, so do you. Yika? Not you too, she mutters. I don't want to hear it, bug killer. Belatedly, you realize, by killing the boil bugs, you made this a harder choice for her. Before, she could have ordered the hunter killed as a mercy, and the bugs would have been at fault. Now it's pragmatism, calm policy. That's on her. You shake your head and step closer. She straightens and turns in an instant, and you assess the defensive orientation of her orogeny. She doesn't do anything with it, doesn't set a torus or start an ambient draw, but then she wouldn't, would she? Those are fulcrum techniques. You don't really know what she's going to do, this strangely trained feral to defend herself. Part of you is curious, in a detached sort of way. The other part notes the tension on her face. So you offer her the still-lit mellow. She blinks at it. Her orogeny settles into quiescence again, but her eyes lift and study yours. Then she tilts her head, bemused, considering. Finally, she puts one hand on her hip, plucks the mellow from your fingers with the other, and takes a long drag. It works quickly. After a moment, she turns to lean back against the crystal, her face settling into weary rather than tense lines as she blows out curls of smoke. She offers it back. You settle beside her and take it. It takes another 10 minutes to finish the cigarette, passing it back and forth between the two of you. Both of you linger, however, after it's done, by unspoken agreement. Only when you hear someone begin to utter loud, broken sobs from the infirmary behind you, do you nod to each other and part ways. It is unfathomable that any sensible civilization would be so wasteful as to fill prime storage caverns with corpses. No wonder these people died out, whoever they were. I estimate another year before we can clear all of the bones, funeral urns, and other debris. Then perhaps another 6 months to fully map and renovate. Less if you can get me those black jackets I requested. I don't care if they cost the earth. Some of these chambers are unstable. There are tablets in there, though. Something in verses, though we can't read this bizarre language. Like stone lore. 5 tablets, not 3. What do you want to do with them? I say we give the lot to Forth, so they'll stop whining about how much history we're destroying. Report of Journeywoman Fogrid Innovator Eumenes to the Janir Licensure, Equatorial East. Proposal to repurpose subsurface catacombs, City of Firawe. Master level review only.
Interlude. A dilemma. You are made of so many people you do not wish to be, including me. But you know so little of me. I will attempt to explain the context of me, if not the detail. It begins, I began, with a war. War is a poor word. Is it war when people find an infestation of vermin in some unwanted place and try to burn or poison it clean? Though that, too, is a poor metaphor, because no one hates individual mice or bedbugs. No one singles out for vengeance that one. That one right there, 3-legged, splotch-backed little bastard and all its progeny down the hundreds of verminous generations that encompass a human life. And the 3-legged, splotch-backed little bastards don't have much chance of becoming more than an annoyance to people. Whereas you and all your kind have cracked the surface of the planet and lost the moon. If the mice in your garden back in Terimo had helped Jija kill Uche, you would have shaken the place to pebbles and set fire to the ruins before you left. You destroyed Terimo anyway. But if it had been personal, you'd have done worse. Yet for all your hatred, you still might not have managed to kill the vermin. The survivors would be greatly changed, made harder, stronger, more splotch-backed. Perhaps the hardships you inflicted would have fissioned their descendants into many factions, each with different interests. Some of those interests would have nothing to do with you. Some would revere and despise you for your power. Some would be as dedicated to your destruction as you were to theirs. Even though by the time they had the strength to actually act on their enmity, you would have forgotten their existence. To them, your enmity would be the stuff of legend. And some might hope to appease you, or talk you around to at least a degree of peaceful tolerance. I am one of these. I was not always. For a very long time, I was one of the vengeful ones. But what it keeps coming back to is this. Life cannot exist without the Earth. Yet there is a not insubstantial chance that life will win its war and destroy the Earth. We've come close a few times. That can't happen. We cannot be permitted to win. So this is a confession, my Aeson. I've betrayed you already, and I will do it again. You haven't even chosen a side yet, and already I fend off those who would recruit you to their cause. Already I plot your death. It's necessary. But I can at least try my damnedest to give your life a meaning that will last till the world ends.
5. Nasun takes the reins.
Mama made me lie to you, Nasun is thinking. She's looking at her father, who's been driving the wagon for hours at this point. His eyes are on the road, but a muscle in his jaw jumps. One of his hands, the one that first struck Uche, ultimately killed him, is shaking where it grips the reins. Nasun can tell that he is still caught up in the fury, maybe still killing Uche in his head. She doesn't understand why, and she doesn't like it. But she loves her father, fears him, worships him, and therefore some part of her yearns to appease him. She asks herself, what did I do to make this happen? And the answer that comes is, lie. You lied. And lies are always bad.
But this lie was not her choice. That had been Mama's command, along with all the others. Don't reach. Don't ice. I'm going to make the earth move, and you'd better not react. Didn't I tell you not to react? Even listening is reacting. Normal people don't listen like that. Are you listening to me? Rusting, stop, for Earth's sake. Can't you do anything right? Stop crying. Now do it again.
Endless commands. Endless displeasure.
Occasionally the slap of ice in threat. The slap of a hand. The sickening inversion of Nasun's torus. The jerk of a hand on her upper arm. Mama has said occasionally that she loves Nasun. But Nasun has never seen any proof of it. Not like Daddy, who gives her napped stone kirkuza to play with, or a first aid kit for her runny sack, because Nasun is a resistant like her mama. Daddy, who takes her fishing at Tirika Creek on days when he doesn't have commissions to fulfill. Mama has never lain out on the grassy rooftop with Nasun, pointing at the stars, and explaining that some dead sieves are said to have given them names, though no one remembers those. Daddy is never too tired to talk at the ends of his work days. Daddy does not inspect Nasun in the mornings after baths the way Mama does, checking for poorly washed ears or an unmade bed. And when Nasun misbehaves, Daddy only sighs and shakes his head and tells her, "Sweet Ning, you knew better." Because Nasun always does. It was not because of Daddy that Nasun wanted to run away and become a lorist. She does not like that her father is so angry now. This seems yet another thing that her mother has done to her. So she says, "I wanted to tell you." Daddy does not react. The horses keep plodding forward. The road stretches before the cart, the woods and hills inching past around the road, the bright blue sky overhead. There aren't a lot of people riding past today. Just some carters with heavy wagons of trade goods, messengers, some courtant guards on patrol. A few of the carters, who visit Terimo often, nod or wave because they know Daddy. But Daddy does not respond. Nasun doesn't like this either. Her father is a friendly man. The man who sits beside her feels like a stranger. Just because he doesn't reply doesn't mean he's not listening. She adds,
"I asked Mama when we could tell you. I asked her that a lot. She said never. She said you wouldn't understand."
Daddy says nothing. His hands are still shaking. Less now? Nasun cannot tell. She starts to feel uncertain. Is he angry? Is he sad about Uche? Is she sad about Uche? It does not feel real. When she thinks of her little brother, she thinks of a gabby, giggling little thing who sometimes bit people and still shit his diaper occasionally, and who had an orogenic presence the size of a quartant. The crumpled still thing back at their house cannot be Uche, because it was too small and dull. Nasun wants to touch her father's shaking hand, but she finds herself oddly reluctant to do so. She isn't sure why. Fear? Maybe just because this man is so much a stranger, and she has always been shy of strangers. But no. He is Daddy. Whatever is wrong with him now, it's Mama's fault. So Nasun reaches out and grips Daddy's nearer hand hard, because she wants to show him that she is not afraid, and because she is angry, though not at Daddy.
"I wanted to tell you."
The world blurs. At first, Nasun isn't sure of what's happening, and she locks up. This is what Mama has drilled her to do in moments of surprise or pain. Lock down her body's instinctive fear reaction. Lock down her Sesapine's instinctive grab for the earth below. And under no circumstances is Nasun to react with orogeny. Because normal people do not do that. "You can do anything else," Mama's voice says in her head. "Scream, cry, Throw something with your hands. Get up and start a fight. Not Orogeny. So Nasun hits the ground harder than she should, because she has not quite mastered the skill of not reacting. And she still stiffens up physically along with not reacting orogenically. And the world blurs, because she has not only been knocked off the driver's seat of the wagon, but she has actually rolled off the edge of the Imperial Road and down a gravel-strewn slope toward a small creek-fed pond. The creek that feeds it is where, in a few days, Esun will bathe a strange white boy who acts as if he has forgotten what soap is for. Nasun flops to a stop, dazed and breathless. Nothing really hurts yet. By the time the world settles and she begins to understand what's happened, Daddy hit me, knocked me off the wagon. Daddy has scrambled down the slope and is crying her name as he crouches beside her and helps her to sit up. Really crying. As Nasun blinks away dust and the stars that obscure her vision, she reaches up in confusion to touch Daddy's face and finds it streaked wet.
I'm sorry, he says. I'm so sorry, sweetening. I don't want to hurt you. I don't. You're all I have left.
He jerks her close and holds her tightly, although it hurts. She has bruises all over.
I'm so sorry. I'm so rusting sorry. Oh, Earth, you evil son of a ruster. Not this one. You can't have this one, too.
These are sobs of grief. Long and throat-scraping and hysterical. Nasun will understand this later, and not very much later. She will realize that in this moment, her father is weeping as much for the son he murdered as for the daughter he has injured. In the moment, however, she thinks, he still loves me, and starts crying, too. So it is while they are like this, Daddy holding Nasun tight, Nasun shaking with relief and lingering shock, that the rippling shockwave of the continent being ripped in half up north reaches them. They are nearly a whole day's travel down the Imperial Road. Back in Terimo, a few moments previous, Esun has just shunted the force of the wave so that it splits and goes around the town, which means that what comes at Nasun is incrementally more powerful. And Nasun has been knocked half insensible, and she is less skilled. Less experienced. When she assesses the onrush of the Sheik and the sheer power of it, she reacts in exactly the wrong way. She locks up again. Her father lifts his head, surprised by her gasp and sudden stiffness, and that is when the hammer lands. Even he assesses the loom of it, though it comes too fast and too powerfully to be anything but a jangle of run, 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 run at the back of his mind. Running is pointless. The shake is basically what happens when a person doing laundry flaps the wrinkles out of a sheet, writ on a continental scale, and moving with the speed and force of a casual asteroid strike. On the scale of small, stationary, crushable people, the strata heave beneath them, and the trees shake and then splinter. The water in the pond beside them actually leaps into the air for a moment. Suspended and still. Daddy stares at it, apparently riveted to the single static point amid the relentless unpeeling of the world everywhere else. But Nasun is still a skilled origin, even if she is a half-addled one. Though she did not muster herself in time to do what Esun did and break the force of the wave before it hits, she does the next best thing. She drives invisible pylons of force into the strata as deep as she can, grabbing the very lithosphere itself. When the kinetic force of the wave hits, incremental instants before the planetary crust above it flexes in reaction, she snatches the heat and pressure and friction from it and uses this to fuel her pylons, pinning the strata and soil in place as solidly as if glued. There's plenty of strength to draw from the earth, but she spins an ambient torus anyway. She keeps it at a wide remove because her father
is within it, and she cannot hurt him. And she spins it hard and vicious, even though she doesn't need to. Instinct tells her to, and instinct is right. The freezing eye wall of her torus, which disintegrates anything coming into the stable zone at its center, is what keeps a few dozen projectiles from puncturing them to death. All of this means that when the world comes apart, it happens everywhere else. For an instant, there is nothing to see of reality save a floating globule of pond, a hurricane of pulverized everything else, and an oasis of stillness at the hurricane's core. Then the concussion passes. The pond slaps back into place, spraying them with muddy snow. The trees that haven't shattered snap back upright, some of them nearly bending all the way in the other direction in reactive momentum and breaking there. In the distance beyond Nasun's torus, people and animals and boulders and trees that have been flung into the air come crashing down. There are screams, human and inhuman, cracking wood, crumbling stone, the distant screech of something man-made and metallic rending apart. Behind them, at the far end of the valley they've just left, a rock face shatters and comes down in an avalanche roar, releasing a large, steaming chalcedony geode. Then there is silence. In it, finally, Nasun pulls her face up from her father's shoulder to look around. She does not know what to think. Her father's arms ease around her, shock, and she wriggles until he lets her go so that she can get to her feet. He does too. For long moments, they simply stare around at the wreckage of the world they once knew. Then Daddy turns to look at her, slowly, and she sees in his face what Uche must have seen in those last moments. "Did you do this?" he asks. The orogeny has cleared Nasun's head of necessity. It is a survival mechanism. Intense stimulation of the sesapine is usually accompanied by a surge of adrenaline and other physical changes that prepare the body for flight, or sustained orogeny, if that is needed. In this case, it brings an increased clarity of thought, which is how Nasun finally realizes that her father was not hysterical over her fall purely for her sake, and that what she sees in his eyes right now is something entirely different from love. Her heart breaks in this moment. Another small, quiet tragedy amid so many others. But she speaks because in the end she is her mother's daughter, and if Esun has done nothing else, she has trained her little girl to survive. "That was too big to be me," Nasun says. Her voice is calm, detached. "What I did is this." She gestures around them, at the circle of safe ground that surrounds them, distinct from the chaos just beyond. "I'm sorry I didn't stop all of it, Daddy. I tried." The daddy is what works. Just as her tears saved her before. The murder in his expression flickers, fades, twists.
"I can't kill you,"
he whispers to himself. Nasun sees the waver of him. It is also instinct that she steps forward and takes his hand. He flinches, perhaps thinking of knocking her away again. But this time, she holds on. "Daddy," she says again, this time putting more of a needy whine into her voice. It is the thing that has swayed him these times when he has come near to turning on her, remembering that she is his little girl, reminding him that he has been, up to today, a good father. It is a manipulation. Something of her is warped out of true by this moment, and from now on, all her acts of affection toward her father will be calculated, performative. Her childhood dies for all intents and purposes. But that is better than all of her dying, she knows. And it works. Jija blinks rapidly, then murmurs something unintelligible to himself. His hand tightens on hers.
Let's get back up to the road, he says.
He is Jija now, in her head. He will be Jija hereafter, forever, and never Daddy again. Except out loud when Nasu needs reins to steer him. So they go back up, Nasun limping a little because her backside is sore where she landed too hard on the asphalt and rocks. The road has been cracked all down its length, though it is not so bad in the immediate vicinity of their wagon. The horses are still hitched, though one of them has fallen to her knees and half entangled herself in the tack. Hopefully she hasn't broken a leg. The other is still with shock. Nasun starts working on calming the horses, coaxing the downed one back up, and talking the other out of near catatonia, while her father goes to the other travelers whom they can see sprawled around the road. The ones who were within the wide circumference of Nasun's torus are okay. The ones who are not, well. Once the horses are shaky but functional, Nasun goes after Jija and finds him trying to lift a man who has been flung into a tree. It's broken the man's back. He's conscious and cursing, but Nasun can see the flop of his now useless legs. It's bad to move him, but obviously Jija thinks it's worse to leave him here like this. Nasun, Jija says, panting as he tries for a better grip on the man. Clear the wagon bed. There's a real hospital at Pleasant Water a day away. I think we can make it if we...
Daddy, she says softly, Pleasant Water isn't there anymore.
He stops. The injured man groans, turns to her, frowning. What?
Sume is gone, too, she says. She does not add,
but Terimo is fine because Mama was there. She doesn't want to go back, not even for the end of the world. Jija darts a glance back down the road they have walked, but of course all they can see are shattered trees and a few overturned chunks of asphalt along the road. And bodies, lots of bodies, all the way to Terimo, or so the eye suggests.
What the rust, he breathes.
There's a big hole in the ground up north, Nasun continues, really big. That's what caused this. It's going to cause more shakes and things, too. I can sense ash and gas coming this way. Daddy, I think it's a season.
The injured man gasps, not entirely from pain. Jija's eyes go wide and horrified. But he asks, and this is important.
Are you sure?
It's important, because it means he's listening to her. It is a measure of trust. Nasun feels a surge of triumph at this, though she does not really know why.
Yes,
she bites her lip.
It's going to be really bad, Daddy.
Jija's eyes drift toward Terimo again. That is conditioned response. During a season, calm members know that the only place they can be sure of welcome is there. Anything else is a risk. But Nasun will not go back, now that she is away. Not when Jija loves her, however strangely, and has taken her away, and is listening to her, understanding her, even though he knows she is an origin. Mama was wrong about that part. She'd said Jija wouldn't understand. He didn't understand Uche. Nasun sets her teeth against this thought. Uche was too little. Nasun will be smarter, and Mama was still only half right. Nasun will be smarter than her, too. So she says softly.
Mama knows, Daddy.
Nasun's not even sure what she means by this. Knows that Uche is dead? Knows who has beaten him to death? Would Mama even believe that Jija could do such a thing to his own child? Nasun can hardly believe it herself. But Jija flinches, as if the words are an accusation. He stares at her for a long moment, his expression shifting from fear through horror through despair. And slowly, to resignation. He looks down at the injured man,
He's no one Nasun knows, not from Terimo, wearing the practical clothes and good shoes of a message runner. He won't be running again, certainly not back to his home, Calm, wherever that is.